Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As this year comes to an end, we thought we'd put together some of our very favorite segments from the past year. It was our first year for the 21st. Let's take a listen to one now. Lisa Creason has her degree in nursing. She's worked for years as a nursing assistant, but the state wouldn't let her take a test to be certified. That's because 20 years ago, she tried to steal cash from the register of a fast food restaurant. At the time, state law blocked her and anyone with some types of felony convictions from receiving licenses in certain fields.
I felt stuck in this house, and I felt like I was meant to be in the hood, like I was meant to be on government assistance, like I was meant to be held below a certain level. And then God said, no, you're not. You're here because I chose you to make this change.
That change included helping pass a new law that allows Lisa's and others with what's called a forcible felony on their record to petition for a license, thanks to the Illinois Policy Institute for that audio. Lisa Creason talked about her experience last week at a panel in Decatur. She's on the phone with us now. She's a community activist, a mom, and a nursing assistant in Decatur, where she joins us from. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
And I should start with congratulations, because you're set to take the test to become a nurse in January. Is that correct?
That is correct. And thank you. I'm so excited.
Now, in August, that's because Governor Rauner signed Senate Bill 42, the legislation that you helped advocate for. Lisa, what does this legislation do?
Well, what Senate Bill 42 does is it fixes the unintended consequences caused by the law in the first place. In 2011, our lawmakers passed a law that placed lifelong restrictions on there's over 120 careers, but in 2011, they addressed the healthcare field for individuals who have been convicted of forcible felonies. Now, forcible felonies can range anywhere from terrorism all the way down to burglary. So there's really no method to that madness. There's like 20 different crimes that fall into that category, and some of which are nonviolent offenses, as mine. However, if you fall into that category, you were restricted from obtaining licensure in Illinois. So Senate Bill 42 lifts that restriction and allows for an individual to petition for their licensure after they've completed whatever required schooling is required for their choice of career, whether it be nursing, respiratory therapist, x-ray technician. I mean, there was a lot of different careers that fell into that one area.
And for you, Lisa, you've been a nursing assistant for how many years?
Since 2005.
Wow. Okay. And what does it mean now to have a registered nurse license? What does that mean for you and your family when you have the chance to do that in January? How will that change things for you?
Well, see, what it will do for me and hundreds of other people across Illinois is it will allow us to become self-sufficient and to be able to contribute to our family's financial security. Many people like myself are currently on some form of government assistance. I was, upon completion of my schooling, I was on subsidized housing, food stamps, medical card. Because I was so serious about not wanting to be a recipient of government programs, I voluntarily walked away from the housing one and then picked up a second job once I had graduated and I had the free time available. But for many of us, it's going to mean that we are able to buy our own food, pay for our own health insurance, possibly buy a home one day, because we will be able to earn the money to do that. And in addition to that, we will also be able to contribute more to the community and to our city with taxes and spending money.
Mm-hmm. What's the salary differential, Lisa? Like in terms of an hour, I wonder if you could even break down for us for an hourly rate, how much a registered nurse would get compared to a nursing assistant.
A nursing assistant, the typical going starting wage is anywhere from $10 to $12 an hour. For a registered nurse, however, brand new, just starting out, the going rate is usually anywhere from 24-ish to 28 an hour.
Wow. So immediately double the salary and maybe as much as three times as much. So that's a huge difference. Lisa, under the new law, what did you have to do in order to be able to apply to take the licensure exam?
Well, see, in 2005, I had already previously obtained a waiver from the state of Illinois to practice in the medical field because I had this 22-year-old felony. So my waiver is still standing because I'm still an active certified nursing assistant. However, that process is the process in which an individual needs to pursue in order to make Senate Bill 42 work for them.
Mm.
If they have a previous conviction and they do not have a waiver from the state of Illinois, then they need to apply for a waiver, and they can do that through the Department of Public Health in Springfield, Illinois. They will send you a packet. You can even go online and download it. But that's the process. And then it allows the individuals responsible for granting the waiver to look at each case on a case-by-case basis.
We've been speaking with Lisa Creason. She's been telling us about her path to getting her registered nursing license, her RN license that will happen in January, how much work she did on Senate Bill 42, which Governor Rauner signed earlier this fall. I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation. Beth Johnson is the director of legal programs at Cabrini Green Legal Aid. She works with ex-offenders across the state to help with jobs, housing, and other areas. Beth, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Beth, as we're hearing Lisa's story, I wonder how many people in Illinois have criminal records or are in situations similar to what Lisa's been describing.
Well, according to a study by the National Employment Law Project, there are an estimated 3.9 million people in Illinois with a criminal record. And so that's not just somebody with a conviction. That's anyone that's ever been arrested has a criminal record. And so across the nation, the number is 1 in 3. Have at some point been arrested, have a criminal record. So the number of people that have convictions, there are many, but we don't necessarily label individuals that have a criminal record as an ex-offender, because sometimes you're arrested and not convicted. Sometimes you're convicted and not actually guilty of the offense which you pled to. And so we work with thousands of people with criminal records that vary across the spectrum.
And when we think about the link between unemployment and staying out of prison or having a record, whether that's an arrest record or not, what comes to mind for people right away is they think about, and there's been a lot of media coverage of the Ban the Box initiative, which was a rule that Illinois passed a couple of years ago. Many states have that, which have basically you're not allowed to ask until later on in the interview process whether or not someone's been convicted of a crime or getting into sort of their criminal background and their history. How much has some initiatives like that helped? Because I know there's been some recent studies as well. In fact, we had a conversation about this on the program, and we'll tweet out the link about how there's one study in particular that shows that actually maybe helps people who have a criminal background, but then hurts African Americans in general across the board. So I wonder, what are we seeing? Like, is the Ban the Box initiative, has that been something that's helped people with a criminal record in terms of employment?
I think it's a piece to the puzzle, but at the end of the day, employers are still faced with a decision whether or not they find out about the record in the beginning of the process or further into it. They need to know how to make individualized decisions, weighing both the candidate before them and the criminal record that comes up on the background check. I think we're moving slowly towards that. Ban the Box wasn't the perfect solution. It's a piece in it. But there is a prevalent problem we have in our society that good people are being barred from opportunities. And studies have shown those that have full-time employment for those leaving prison are less likely to end up back in prison because they have employment. And as a human level, just like Lisa speaks about wanting to pursue the career she was made for, employment can define a human being, right? It gives you a purpose to wake up in the morning. And if we're barring people because of their past, we're having a lot of people that are being disenfranchised from the right opportunities.
Mm. I mean, when you say that employment can define a human being, I wonder, as we're thinking about that, are there other ways that state and federal laws, the culture thing, I think I want to get to in a little bit and talk about that, the employer culture and all of that stuff. And Lisa, I'd love to hear your perspective on that, too. But Beth, I want to ask you first, are there other ways that state and federal laws are preventing people from finding jobs?
I mean, absolutely. There are a cataloged 45,000 collateral consequences in the United States. A collateral consequence is every implication against a person after they serve their sentence. 45,000 laws that say you can't work here, you can't live here, you can't get this license, you can't be in this school. So we've done really good as a nation about imposing all these barriers, and now our challenge is to slowly start rolling those back. We want it done quickly. It's happening slowly. SB 42 was a great example of that, rolling back these thousands of laws that are posing lifetime barriers to self-sufficiency.
And then apart from the laws, there is the whole cultural point. Lisa, what has been your experience with employers? What do you think needs to change in terms of a culture of having people like you have the ability to, for example, in your case, have a full RN license?
Well, see, I think there's a lot we can do on that. First of all, when individuals like myself come home from prison, it's already very discouraging because you face so many obstacles and limitations. And a lot of times people don't know if they should be honest going to an interview or how they should present themselves going into an interview. And I think we need to have some of those programs available for individuals prior to coming home so that they're not caught so off guard. But for the employers themselves, there's a stereotype that automatically comes into play when you mention someone has a felony record or a criminal record. And we really need to move past that as just human beings, because everyone has a past, and everyone has done something in their life at one point or another that they're not proud of, whether it was an illegal action, a legal action, or an immoral action. We all know what it's like to regret something that we've done, and we need to lean on that side of our humanity and give people a second chance. And just judge them based on what they've done since the mistake and not the mistake itself, because the mistake does not define us as people.
I appreciate you saying that, Lisa. Beth, I wonder how many people even have a chance to prove themselves because they aren't even given an opportunity to find work. Do you think that's often the case?
I would agree with that.
Yeah, I'd say more often than not that's the case, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, Lisa, that's what you think. Beth, what do you think?
I think that people are prevented from being able to display the human being they are today. All too often, that black and white piece of paper is what an employer has historically been used to using as a screening tool. And employer education is a huge component, too. We can't be changing laws and not be changing hearts and minds at the same time. A lot of that comes along with exposure. Now that you are allowed to consider somebody with a criminal record if you were previously a regulated industry, how do you make those decisions? How do you make the best decisions for your place of business in hiring the best candidate? And so part of advocacy around these issues can't just be changing laws and educating people with criminal records, but it's also educating employers or landlords or institutions so we take full effect and start changing our views overall in society.
Beth, we're just about a minute to the break. I just wanted to ask quickly if you could tell me what those regulated industries are now that we've talked about, nursing, for example. What are the industries now that as of January will be covered under this new law?
So SB 42 deals with healthcare licenses. A bill was passed to remove lifetime barriers to employment for previous drug convictions for schools and park districts. So those were all a package of bills that made their way through the Illinois General Assembly, being led by people like Lisa, those that are the experts because they are the ones living this and making sure we're rolling back these lifetime absolute barriers in our laws in Illinois.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue the conversation with Beth Johnson. She's the director of legal programs at Cabrini Green Legal Aid. I want to thank Lisa Creason. I know, Lisa, you've got to get back to work, so I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. Lisa Creason from Decatur, where she works there at a nursing facility. Lisa, thanks so much for being with us.
Not a problem. You guys have a good day.
All right. You have a good day. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We're going to pick up this conversation in just a minute. Stay tuned to this Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is an Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about ex-offenders, people who have a criminal background, the challenges that are posed with getting people who have this background to employment. We were just hearing from an ex-offender, Lisa Creason, one of the people who lobbied very hard for Senate Bill 42, which is now will take effect in January. That is for people in the nursing industry for certain categories, now allowing them to allow for full licensure. My guests are Beth Johnson. She's the director of legal programs at Cabrini Green Legal Aid. They work with ex-offenders across Illinois on issues related to jobs, housing, and other areas. Beth, just before we took a break, we were just talking about different challenges. We were talking about laws. I know that you all at Cabrini Green Legal Aid, you run a help desk. What are the typical problems that you see playing out for people in the work that you do with getting back to employment? How much of is it what Lisa was saying about people coming out of prison and then not even being clear about what resources are available to them?
I think people leaving our state institutions, our prisons, definitely have a more difficult time because of the lack of support and resources upon returning home. And we do see individuals that come directly from prison to our help desks. But as I mentioned before, we serve people with criminal records, and that could be anything from an arrest to a conviction. We meet people across the spectrum that haven't been arrested in 20 years. We meet people that are still getting arrested today because the criminal system impacts people's lives in so many different ways. And so what we do is have attorneys available five shifts a week. We see about 5,000 people a year that come to us because they've experienced some barrier, right? They're trying to get a job and they're told no because of their record. They're trying to get an apartment but couldn't move in because the landlord screened them out. They're trying to be licensed in some profession, but they can't because of their record. So our services are there, but it's often reactionary to a barrier. 92% of the people that come to us list the reason that they're coming is to find employment or better employment because of some barrier they faced because of what's on their criminal record.
Mm. And when we think about that, 92% of people who are coming to see you are trying to find employment, first of all, or better employment. How often is it the case that laws like Senate Bill 42 pass and then people may not even be aware that this change has happened?
That's a huge issue across any policy agenda item that you would find, is that passing a bill is one thing. Making sure people know about it and it's implemented is a whole second stage of the process to complete it. The coalition we worked with, the Restoring Rights and Opportunities Coalition of Illinois, is comprised of policy folks, organizers, and the real experts, people with records that are experiencing these barriers, like Lisa, who take the time to travel to Springfield to share their stories and the impact of these laws and regulations. In terms of what bills are actually being worked on at this time and were passed, those were big industries. Schools are a big employer. park districts are big employment, especially for young people. And might I mention the park district bill that just passed changed the law because previously kids who were adjudicated delinquent as a juvenile were even barred from working in park districts because of drug offenses on their record. And those are things that we just need to change as a society. And there was a really good leadership example shown this year in Springfield.
As we are talking about this, I want to bring two more people into this conversation as we're talking about not just juvenile records, but also expungement and other records. Katie Blakeman is with the Champaign County Circuit Clerk. Beth is actually working with her with Cabrini Green Legal Aid for an event this weekend in Champaign. It's called the Expungement and Record Sealing Summit. Katie's in studio with us now. Hey, Katie, welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And we are going to get to juvenile records in a few minutes with Karina Lopez, who's with the Illinois Justice Project, to the point that you were making earlier, Beth, about juvenile records in particular. Let's start with adult records and Katie Blakeman. Katie, you're the Champaign County Circuit Clerk, and you're organizing this event. Can you explain for us, first of all, I think maybe we should define terms. This is an expungement and record sealing summit. What does expungement mean?
So expungement is a remedy that is available to some people with criminal records that if they petition the court to have that record expunged. If it is granted, what happens with that record is that the police agencies, the arresting agencies, actually either return those records to you or destroy them. And then the record in the circuit clerk's office, who is the county keeper of the record, and the state police restrict greatly the access to those records. So it's no longer public record. Even law enforcement does not have access to those records. So expungement is the most sort of
extreme example.
Extreme example.
Sealing just means obviously then people don't have who has if something if a record is sealed, who has access to a sealed record?
So it's a very limited. It's only with court order. So for example, if that person is it certainly is removed from public record. So it's not going to show up on a search. You know, a lot of counties have a public search process on their websites. You can search for criminal records. It's not going to show up there. It wouldn't show up on a background check.
So it wouldn't show up on a background check.
It would show up on a fingerprint background check and law enforcement. If you were applying to become a police officer, it would show up there, but it would not show up.
But what if you were doing fingerprints for working with children or things like that? I know sometimes that happens.
Beth, I think, would have a better answer.
Yeah, Beth, I wonder if you could start with that, Beth, because I have a question about when records are sealed, also about what the, why don't we start with the fingerprinting? When a record is sealed, when does that show up?
So as Katie was correctly pointing out, law enforcement always has access to all sealed records. So although removed from the public domain, law enforcement still has it for their purposes. When it comes to sealed records, only felony convictions that are eligible to be sealed and sealed by the court are available to employers that are regulated by law to conduct fingerprint-based background checks. These are industries such as schools, park districts, healthcare, children's service agencies, like you mentioned. So if somebody is sealing a record, the only thing that's able for them to see is a sealed felony conviction.
And what do you recommend, Beth? What do you tell people when if they've gone through this process and they've had a record sealed? What do you tell job applicants or people who have these backgrounds about what they're supposed to disclose to people in a job process?
So for employers?
No, for the person
outside of the
I'm sorry, what do you tell applicants for what they should disclose to an employer, a potential employer?
Yes. So for employers that aren't regulated by a law, applicants do not have to disclose those records. They're protected under our Illinois Human Rights Act from employment discrimination based on a sealed record. So they are no longer required to disclose that to potential employers that aren't regulated by a law.
And from your standpoint, Beth, how important is the expungement and record sealing process? How important a step is that for people in terms of then being able to get a job? Or as you said, 92% of the people that come to you are looking for either employment or better employment.
It allows them to not have to have that be part of the discussion, and the focus is solely on their qualifications for that job. So it does have a huge impact on individual lives. But I think the thing to point out is, even when you're not eligible to seal a conviction on your record, there are still other forms of relief that you could seek to improve your employment opportunities. Lisa mentioned a health care waiver before. There's things such as certificates of good conduct. You can still move forward in your life without a sealed record. And one of the really great things about the event that Katie Blakeman is putting on Saturday, it's bringing that information to people as well. Because expungement and sealing is great for those that are eligible, but there are many other things too to help people get back into the workforce.
Katie, how much of this event on Saturday, now this is available for people just within Champaign County?
So it's designed to assist people who have a record in Champaign County. So they may not actually live in Champaign County anymore, but perhaps, you know, were arrested in Champaign County or were charged in Champaign County. And so at this time, we're able to help people with Champaign County records.
Mm-hmm. And how important is it? Do you find that in as county circuit clerk for you that a lot of people, this sounds like it's a really difficult system to navigate in terms of paperwork and understanding the laws. And I imagine most people are not able to do the years of work that our previous guest Lisa did in order to figure out how to navigate the system and apply for all these licenses. I imagine something like this is designed to help people with this.
Absolutely, absolutely. That is the primary purpose of holding an event like this. This is the first event that we've had in Champaign County, but Cook County has had a similar type of event for more than 10 years. I actually attended their annual summit last summer, and at that time was incredibly inspired by what they were able to do in Cook County. So the majority of the people that we see coming into our office, and we hear very similar stories. You know, we hear people telling us that, you know, I was arrested 20 years ago, or, you know, I got court supervision. It wasn't even a conviction. And, you know, it's still preventing me from getting a better job or getting a job at all. It's preventing them from moving forward and supporting their families. And so because the majority of the people are looking for employment or for better employment, they typically do not have a lot of financial resources. And so hiring an attorney to help them figure all of this out is really just a pipe dream. I mean, that it for most people, it's really, really not possible. So this particular event brings together attorneys, volunteer attorneys who can assist people with viewing their criminal record and helping them figure out, based on what's there, what remedies might you be eligible for, and then assistance in completing the petition. And then, because it is an event hosted by the Circuit Clerk's office, and we have permission from the court to have a special court day, meaning we can accept filings on a not Monday through Friday basis, they'll actually be able to file the petition with us that day. And accompanying that is a blanket fee waiver, because there's typically filing fees associated with filing petitions for these forms of relief. And so we are able to accept those filings for free Saturday, which is just a huge, huge, huge thing for this.
That's Katie Blakeman. We're going to tweet out information about the Champaign County event. And there's one last issue that I wanted to get to with Karina Lopez. Karina, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We were just talking about Cook County. We were also talking about juveniles. And as Katie's been going through this very lengthy process for adults, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the Expungio app that you've developed to help juveniles expunge their records. We mentioned 3.6 million adults. How are there thousands of juveniles in Illinois, is that correct, Karina, who haven't been able to expunge their juvenile records?
Right. So there was actually recently a report published by the Illinois Juvenile Justice Commission about juveniles and the expungement rates. And it studied the arrest records of juveniles between 2004 and 2014. And there is approximately 1.8 million arrests within those 10 years. And for every 1,000 arrest records, only 3 were expunged. So that's not even 1%. That's 0.29%.
Wow.
Which is drastic and really needs some addressing.
And we've been talking about resources at this event. You helped develop an app a couple of years ago. What does the app do?
So the app is primarily a connection to resources. For a young person, as it's been said, it's been difficult to find people that can help them, but they definitely are out there. So this website aims to first help someone find out if they're eligible to expunge their record and if whatever offense they have qualifies under the expungement statutes. And then it'll connect them directly to some folks that are volunteering or helping out at the Juvenile Expungement Help Desk, and that's staffed by the Cabrini Green Legal Aid and Legal Assistance Foundation. So that's great on their work, and they've done a lot for them.
How many people, this app's been around for a couple of years, how many people have used it, Karina?
So right now we're still going to be tracking that just because it is hard. There's a connection point that's hard to track. So a lot of people can visit the website and find out if they're eligible, but there was sometimes difficulties for youth to continue on the process because it can be long and it can be complicated. So once they're talking to lawyers and see that, you know, you need to go to this.
So it's really to connect people, right?
Right.
So it's resources. Right. I know this was developed when you were with the MCFA Challenge Juvenile Justice Council. I wonder, Karina, as we've been talking about all of these issues, how important do you think it is for people who have juvenile records to make sure that they are having those either expunged or sealed, which they can do start to do with the app? How important is that?
Well, I think it's really important to consider what Beth and Katie have said, that it is important to get it done because it's going to remove some barriers to education, employment, and housing and any other kind of opportunities in the future. But also you can still go on with the record, especially since it's juvenile. It should be kept confidential. But that report I mentioned also highlighted some broad sharing, both in the legal and illegal perspective. So it's important to do it, but also to remember that you have the right to do so.
Right. And it sounds like that's a lot of echoing the themes of what we've been talking about today, for people to know the rights that they have. I want to thank Karina Lopez. She's with the Illinois Justice Project, for sharing with us about the Expungio app. We'll tweet out the links to that. We'll have that all at our website, www.21stshow.org, so you can see those resources. I want to thank also Katie Blakeman, Champaign County Circuit Clerk. The event is in Urbana from 8:30 to 5 o'clock on Saturday, the Expungement and Record Sealing Summit. It's free. We'll tweet all that information. We've got it all on our website as well. I want to thank Katie Blakeman as well as Beth Johnson with Cabrini Green Legal Aid. Beth, it sounds like Cabrini Green Legal Aid is really doing a lot of work on this throughout the state. So thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. Stay tuned to hear more of this encore edition of the show. Coming up, we'll have more stories and news from across Illinois. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Alyssa Altman is a James Beard Award winner for her blog, Poor Man's Feast. She's also a monthly writer for The Washington Post. So it's no surprise that her memoir about growing up in a Jewish enclave of Queens in the 1970s weaves food throughout her sometimes painful recollections of her childhood. The book is called Trafe, My Life as an Unorthodox Outlaw. She's actually speaking this evening in Chicago at the Seminary Co-op Bookstore in conjunction with the University of Chicago Hillel. And she's with us now. Hi, Alyssa. Welcome to The 21st.
Thanks so much for having me.
There's a line in the book where your grandfather tells your father he smells like trafe. Can you explain what trafe is to us?
Yes. Well, trafe is the sort of colloquial expression that one would use for anything that is considered not kosher under Jewish law. So that would be under Talmudic law. So, for example, pork, the mixing of meat and dairy, shrimp, shellfish, fish without scales, and of course, it also has a double meaning. It can mean, you know, a person who has gone astray, anything that is sort of on the outside looking in, that's different, unacceptable, dirty, unclean, etc., etc.
And you have written about your family, especially about your mom, for years. But this is very different from your usual food writing and from your first book, which was a food memoir. What was behind wanting to share these stories about your family and about your childhood?
Well, I think certainly, you know, writing Poor Man's Feast, which was the first memoir, there were bits and pieces of it that really sort of dug deep about how I came to food, how I came to think of the table as a place of sort of sanctity and sanctuary, and how I then turned that into, you know, really being the sort of the center of my life and kind of everything that I think of and do. And I found myself thinking about my grandparents and certainly how I came to food. I came to food by way of both my father and my mother in very different ways. I mean, my mother is not a food person at all. She's a former model. She's a former television singer. And she's always had a fraught relationship with food. And my father was the complete and polar opposite of that. And so as I wrote Poor Man's Feast and started to also write longer form narratives on the blog about how I came to it and how they came to it, that, of course, then really compelled me to think about the people who came before them. And I was lucky enough to know both sets of grandparents. I didn't have them for very long, but they were very dear to me, and they were about as different as night and day. And they took up residence in my brain and in my heart and in my kitchen, and it was kind of the next obvious thing for me.
And of course, food does play such a prominent role in the story. Some of it's not very good, by the way. So I think that's a whole other interesting thing too, right? How you ended up in food writing when some of this food sounds pretty bad.
Well, like it's kind of a funny thing. I mean, and I've spoken about this recently, that in the food writing community, and certainly in the visual food community, you know, if you go onto Instagram and there are all of these really beautiful, lush looking, images of beautiful bowls.
Everything has to be perfect, right?
Everything has to be perfect, and you know, with the food magazines and food newspaper and food media, everything's perfect, and everybody aspires to be a chef and a home cook and so on and so forth. But the fact of the matter is that food, like anything in life, is sort of a two-edged sword. There's good food and there's not good food. There's good experience and there's not good experience. And it's something that we I think culturally just don't talk about. And it's almost as though, you know, we're afraid to take the bad with the good, and this is life. This is the way we live. This is who we are. It's what makes us human.
Well, and then the bad, the one thing that stands out for me, and I think every child has this, although I think your story is particularly horrific, when you have a grandparent or someone who tries to force you to eat something that's kind of, you know, especially to a child, gross. And it's when your grandmother tries to make you have brains. She makes you eat brains, and your dad is like, she's too young to eat this right now. And you're kind of spared. But the context of that, and then that whole story, I wonder if you could share that, because it was like, that was already this very fraught kind of experience where you go over to your grandparents and your mom refuses. She's just like, I'm not going in there. And so you're already not in a good situation as a kid.
Well, I was already not in a good situation. So it was 1974. It was December 1974. I was 11 years old. And every Sunday of my childhood, my parents and I would throw me into the car, and we would drive from Queens all the way out along the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway to my father's parents' house near Coney Island. It was about 3 subway stops in from Coney Island. So it was a very, very, very distant Brooklyn. And I loved them. Going into their house was like taking a step back in time. They were old country people. My grandfather had emigrated from the Ukraine in 1905. My grandmother came from of Romania when she was 2 years old, so she didn't remember any of it. But walking into their house, I mean, things, their food was a little bit different. The way they spoke was a little bit different. You know, they spoke mostly in Yiddish if they didn't want me to understand what they were saying, which was a lot of the time. And so we went out this one particular Sunday morning, and my parents were having a fight of some sort in the car. And when we arrived there at my grandparents' house, my mother refused to get out of the car. She said, "I'm not getting out of the car. I don't want to see them." And my father was furious, and so he pulled me out of the car. We went upstairs to my grandparents' house, and I sat down. I was sort of ushered into the kitchen to sit down, where my grandmother had a kitchen table, and I could hear her behind me. I couldn't see her, but I could hear her opening up the refrigerator and taking out a jar, and I heard spooning and thwack, thwack, thwack on the countertop. And she came over to me, and she sort of bent over my shoulder and put a plate down right in front of me, and on the plate was a cold boiled calf's brain. And as if that wasn't bad enough.
That looked like a brain, obviously. Ugh.
It was a brain. It was a brain. It was a calf's brain, so it was probably about the size of my adult fist. But at that point, at 11 years old, it might as well have been a Volkswagen. I mean, it was huge, you know. But if that was not enough, I had seen Young Frankenstein just the day before.
Oh, no.
And, you know, of course, everybody probably remembers the Young Frankenstein, Abby Normal scene, and, you know, Abby who, Abby Normal. And I just stared at this thing, and I didn't know what to do with it. I'd never seen anybody eat a brain before. I'd never seen a brain before anywhere except the day before in Young Frankenstein. And my father came in and sort of took it out from in front of me, and he said to my grandmother, "The baby doesn't eat brains yet." And I thought, here's the thing. I'm never going to eat brains.
Yet.
But my conclusion, you know, because kids get from, you know, point A to point Z in interesting ways. But so I concluded that my mother knew about that was what was on the menu for the day, and that was why she stayed downstairs. Which was a little crazy.
I'm speaking with Alyssa Altman. Her latest book is called Trafe, My Life as an Unorthodox Outlaw. And you have elements of Jewish culture and food in this memoir that are both embraced, and then other things that are just kind of thrown out the window. And I wonder, is that something you thought very much about as a child at the time, that there were certain things that happened and certain things that didn't, and certain things that were contradictory?
Well, you know, I wouldn't say that I consciously thought about it, but I certainly, as a child growing up in the late 1960s and 70s, to parents, my mother is completely assimilated, and neither of my parents was really observant as an adult. My father grew up in a Orthodox home, and had a very fraught relationship with his religion, and therefore was not compelled to have me bat mitzvah or anything like that. But
you also prayed. Like, there's a lot of prayer.
I think that the praying, though, I was just talking to another journalist about this today, that I think certain people are compelled and pulled toward the spiritual. And for whatever reason, I always have been, naturally, and it was always there. And it's something that I carry with me even to this day, although I am not I don't have an observant Jewish practice. But at that time, it was a very contradictory time of great paradox. I mean, here we were, you know, 20 years after the Holocaust. American Jews in the United States were, consciously or not consciously, were really becoming members of society that possibly up until that point that they were not part of, or that they were not able to be part of. And so, but at the same time, it was like, well, okay, we have the menorah, but Christmas is everywhere, and every Jewish child of some you know, some assimilation can recall saying, "Gee, you know, why can't I want a Christmas tree? All the other kids have Christmas trees," and so there was that kind of contradiction. There was also the contradiction of going to my best friend's bat mitzvah, which is really what opens the book. In it was also, I want to say, 1974, and these were in fact observant people, and it was a conservative bat mitzvah. And after the bat mitzvah was over, we all went over to the local Chinese restaurant,
right? Yeah.
And ate, you know, wonton soup and ate shrimp and lobster sauce and egg rolls and. You know, and my father used to say that that pork was only kosher when it was in an egg roll. And, of course, you know, I think that some of us will understand what that means.
And
but,
some people
but,
will and, not, but right. Yeah.
And some people will not understand what that means. And if they you know, come to hear me speak, I'll explain it. But, you know, I said to my father that at that bat mitzvah, "Dad, you know, what is this meat floating in my wonton soup?" And he said, "Just, you know, shut up and eat your soup." Just, you know. And so it was always this push-pull, contradiction, paradox of assimilation. How much do I bring with me from the old country? How much do I leave behind? A lot of it was not conscious. A lot of it was almost a sort of like a dance of acceptance and tolerance and not understanding really where one was standing vis-a-vis assimilation and acceptance one day versus the next day. And of course, you know, we're seeing a lot of that now.
Well, and I have one more question I was going to ask you, and we just have about a minute left, but it, so much of it think of is this is about identity. And do you think that's something we never really truly stop figuring out? Is that something that's kind of a constant process?
I think identity, no matter who we are, and I've had a lot of readers who are not Jewish, who are Italian, Irish, Muslim, and every reader under the sun has at some point said to me, "This is my story." And I think that the fact of identity is something that is constantly changing. It's constantly morphing. It's something that is always changing. And we as humans are not always comfortable with change. And, you know, I think that we have to grow more comfortable with the concept of ambiguity and change. And that's something that I struggle with every day, and most of us do, as I said, consciously or not.
Alyssa Altman is a writer. Her most recent book is called Trafe, My Life as an Unorthodox Outlaw. Alyssa, thank you so much for being with me. That does it for this special Encore edition of The 21st. Thanks for listening. You can always find Fast Shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you want to send us an email, leave us a voicemail, follow us on social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow that for the latest Illinois news. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st. To like us, you can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Hala Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.